Hello and welcome to The Lawyer Podcast. I'm Katrin Griffiths, editor of The Lawyer.
And I'm Christian Smith, litigation editor of The Lawyer.
And hello down under, Christian. Listeners, for this episode, Christian is coming to us all the way from the other side of the globe.
That's right. I'm basking in the New Zealand summer sun, although it is nighttime here now. I feel like I haven't earned it, really, though, because the country's been through some torrid storms in the past few weeks.
And the legal market is going through torrid storms here in the UK, is it not, Christian? We could not deny listeners The Lawyer Podcast. So this week, we are bringing you The Lawyer Podcast kind of international.
Yes, and as much as that was an amazing impromptu bridge there, nothing on it's going to really be actually international, is it?
No, we're actually very, very domestic this week in The Lawyer Podcast.
We will take you north to Leeds and to our deputy news editor, Jessica Boke, who will explain to us just how rapidly that market is expanding.
And also on this episode, the legal profession has had a very long and somewhat close history with alcohol. But as the profession becomes more diverse, do lawyers need to be more inclusive for those who don't drink for whatever reason? Our in-house reporter Lucy Cruz sits down with one lawyer who wants to bring about some change.
But first, as I'm sure many listeners will know, the last couple of years have seen a dramatic rise in lateral recruitment in the city.
Our Director of Insight, Matt Byrne, has been diving into the data behind some of this recruitment. Matt, among the happiest people in the city at the moment, actually for the last few years, have been the headhunters. They're very influential because they've also made pots of money moving partners hither and thither. And now you are sitting on a huge pile of statistics on partner moves in the city. What is your prognosis?
It's really interesting, actually, because as you speak to some people, they may be recruiters. Possibly say it's going to be another bumper year this year, and speak to other people, for example, some of the managing partners we spoke to for this report, less optimistic about that.
It is funny when you speak to recruiters how they seem to think that now is always the best time to move firms. always, it was better than the last time actually. Now just so happens to be the best time.
It's a downturn, this is the time to move.
There's never been a better time. Yeah. So we have got a bumper stack of statistics. What we've done, the basic premise for this city signal report is last year's lateral move, but we've also got 3 years worth of data as well. So we've tracked which firms have made the most hires. Interestingly, also, who's got the biggest number of exits.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. So it might not surprise lots of people listening to this that the firm that's lost the most over the last 3 years is BCLP. Something over 30 partners have gone, according to our data. But second or third in that ranking is DLA, who've lost something like 23 partners, but they've hired 25. So on that basis, they've got a net gain of two partners over the last 3 years.
That's a weird way to exhibit growth, isn't it?
Whatever it takes. But
you're also paying headhunters fees on top of that. So it feels like a very expensive way of just growing your partnership by two.
Well, and also just to clarify, our data only looks at proper laterals. So if you're a senior associate and you're joining a firm as a partner that you're not included, or if you're Clyde & Co and you've snapped up 43 partners at BLM, that's not included either. And what we've focused the report on is the top five firms by the numbers of laterals that they brought in last year, and that is DLA, Eversheds, Addleshaws, Osborne Clark, and Paul Hastings.
Paul Hastings is a very interesting, talking to Christian's sort of point about the persuasion of headhunters is interesting there, because right now, you know, leveraged finance partners moving is a bit of an odd one given the dearth of deals.
Yeah.
But actually there is one sector where is super hot at the moment, and that's energy, isn't it? Energy and infrastructure. Matt, tell us a little bit more about sort of why this is and why this suddenly becomes so sexy.
Well, it was very interesting to see those five firms that I mentioned. All five of them have brought in energy, natural resources, infrastructure partners within the last year. So I think the most recent was Paul Hastings, and they brought in a couple from Linklaters, Jessamy Gallagher and Stuart Rosen. But, you know, Kirkland has also done a big pivot and decided that energy and infrastructure is where it's at. In the UK, anyway, in London, in the States, it's a different matter. And of course, there's a number of firms who are very focused on that sector anyway. So all of those five firms who are ranked in our report by the number of laterals purely have all brought in energy and natural resources partners in the last year. And I think it's just indicative of the amount of money that is rattling around in that sector. I mean, according to McKinsey, it's trillions of dollars over the next decade that is going to be spent. And that's clearly just loads of work for corporate and finance lawyers, but also the sector specialists, the really, you know, gritty.
That's really interesting because I was speaking to a litigation partner recently in the same vein who was essentially saying, you know, they had sort of, you know, bet the house on investing in renewable energy litigation in particular and that sort of area, as well as nuclear, and whether or not you put nuclear and renewables is another debate for another day. But and essentially, you know, they just say it's going to keep growing, it's going to grow, it's going to grow, and it's not necessarily just that they need to take competition, you know, to take clients from others. The clients are just growing. The market share, the pie is growing itself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other interesting thing about the energy market and the renewables market and this whole green transition is that you're kind of making it up as you go along. You know, I'm exaggerating for effect, clearly, but it is a new area with new techniques and new knowledge. So in a sense, building your team is quite easy from the bottom because you can get associates in and they can sort of learn with you. But there's a lot of retooling, I think, happening as well. So it isn't just there's a small pool of energy lawyers and that's all you have. It's actually all sorts of people who are coming from different directions to really look at this sector.
Well, it's also an insanely attractive area to be working in at the moment, isn't it? You know, if you are a younger lawyer, NQ, whatever, first, second year associate, you want to work in that area because it's where the action is at. And nuclear, by the way, is indeed a green technology under EU taxonomy, according to Stephen Hill of Evershed. So thank you, Stephen.
Well, there you go.
And they've just recruited Matt Honeyburn from, he was at Linklaters and Norton Rose. So it's absolutely an area. So, excuse the pun, but it's a very hot area.
Absolutely. Anything else that we should look out for, do you think, when you've been talking to managing partners and headhunters?
Yeah, I mean, look, going back to what we were saying at the beginning, the managing partners are speaking to pretty unanimously. They think that this year they're not going to be bringing in as many as they did last year. It's not a great time to be looking to increase headcount. I think that's a pretty clear area. But at the same time, and we're looking at US firms' financials at the moment, and it's going to be interesting to see what the overall is and what the average is for those firms. But in London, it's still a growth area for a lot of these firms. They are one of the most active in terms of office moves, just as another indicator. So you'll be seeing US firms moving in London during the course of this year. They've got to fill those offices. And actually, quite often with US firms, they're actually taking more space, whereas legacy UK firms, the trend is to take less space in London. So I think that's another area where we'll definitely see some activity. It's a well-trodden path, the move from UK firms to US firms. It's not going away anywhere soon.
Well, long gone are the days, at least as far as we know, of a drinks trolley being pushed around a firm on a Friday afternoon. But go to any law firm event and alcohol is still very much front and center. Indeed, often alcoholic drinks are the only ones on offer. Our in-house reporter Lucy Cruz assesses whether the legal sector needs to change that.
Today, we are joined by Sana Shafi, who is an associate at Kirkland & Ellis and founder of a social mobility charity called Strive, which is aimed at pushing for better representation in law. Hi, Sana.
Hey, Lucy.
I'm excited to have you on today because we obviously saw your LinkedIn post about the sort of culture around alcohol in law and how this could be better. So would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think I've been in law for about, over 3 years now. And the story goes even further back, you know, back when I was a RAC schemer and attending these events and even just going for networking. And it was one of the first sort of things that I noticed when I was very young was that for the first couple of times, it was obviously very exciting because I had never been to a networking event before. So at first it was like, oh, this is really snazzy. This is really nice. And then as I went to more and more of those, I noticed that there was always only orange juice and this red blackcurrant thing on offer at pretty much every single one of them. I mean, like barring one or two exceptions that I can't even recall at the moment, but there was always just these two options. And then you would look over at the non-booze table, sorry, you look over at the booze table and there was a lot more, you know, they would have like red wine and there was white wine and there was beer and, you know, there were all of these different mixes and there was always somebody available to top up your glass and all of that stuff. It just felt like the attention and the thought that was put into people that were drinking and the choices that would be available to them, it was a lot more well thought out and considered as compared to the choices that were available for people that weren't drinking. And so, and this has just sort of been my experience for a number of years now. And I just thought, you know, there's a lot of options. It's not that you can't make quality non-alcoholic drinks because, you know, you absolutely can. There are really nice mocktails out there, which is where that hashtag Virgin Pina Coladas for All came from. You know, there is
love that.
I love a good Virgin Pina Colada. I think it's great. There's just so much variety out there. And, you know, for the large part, you know, you can have a little bit of elderflower syrup and a little bit of like fizzy water. And you can even that, like, that's quite basic, but even that is quite nice and refreshing and it's pretty to look at. And it's just, it just makes you feel like you are part of what's going on and you just haven't been given this little like Tesco orange juice bitter with bits and two Diet Coke.
You feel so much better included.
Exactly. It's just like, you know, somebody has really thought about what is available for you and you also just don't stick out like a sore thumb, you know, and also it's just a little bit less tiring having the same options again and again and again. And so I was just thinking about that on that particular day. And it just prompted me to just put it out there and see if everybody else was experiencing the same thing or if it was just me that felt this way. So I was not prepared for the reaction that I got on LinkedIn, to be honest. I wasn't ready for the amount of like, you know, corresponding stories that people had to what I posted. And it obviously got the conversation going and so many people then reached out over DM to say the same thing. And I was like, well, you know, this is a problem. If everybody's thinking the same thing, but it hasn't been addressed, then maybe it's time that we do something. And for me, it's such an easy fix because
it is, isn't it?
Exactly. Like, it's not like one of those things that requires a huge amount of like investment in terms of financial investment or anything, or even like time. It's literally a very small change. And it's one of those changes that is quick and easy to make, but has such a wide impact in terms of the wider D&I piece. And one of the comments that really stuck with me on that particular post was one where somebody said that as somebody who often doesn't like to drink, they feel pressure to drink because when they're drinking something that is non-alcoholic, it is immediately obvious that they're having something that's orange juice or whatever that might be, and it just makes them stand out and it just makes them feel that much more self-conscious that everybody else is drinking and so they should be as well. And that's a piece that I actually had never thought about as somebody who doesn't drink. I think,
do you know what, Sana, I remember going to some different law events when I was doing my vacation scheme, and what I really didn't like was that there was just no consistency in them, so you never knew if there was going to be a non-alcoholic option. And I had exactly that experience where I had to ask for the non-alcoholic option and I was just told, oh, just put a tab on at the bar then for non-alcoholic drinks and we'll pick it up at the end. But that raised so many questions from my peers, and I remember the guy sat next to me being like, oh, you don't drink, what's that about? And you know, it's not like, for me, it's fine. It's my religious preference, so I don't mind sharing that. But other people have reasons they don't necessarily want to share, and actually you shouldn't need to. Something that I do like, as I don't know if you know, that Shoesmiths does student recruitment events that are completely alcohol free. That's like their standard policy now, which is really nice. And their tagline is that at Shoesmiths we don't need alcohol to have fun. And I sort of, I love that thinking, like, it's not a necessity. You don't need it to network. You don't need it to have fun. It should definitely be normalized. Just the small thoughts can make people feel so much more included and equally valued. So thank you so much for your comments, Sana, for coming on the podcast today. We've really appreciated it.
Our deputy news editor, Jessica Boak, joins us now, and she's been getting under the skin of the Leeds legal market for the past few months. Jess, it is becoming a lot more attractive to national firms, isn't it? What is happening with Leeds at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I've only been reporting on the city for about 8-9 months now. And obviously, there are so many firms here that can date their roots back something like the 1700s. And so I think it's been a big market for a while, arguably whether it's second to London for a while. It depends if you're in Manchester, Leeds.
Yeah, Manchester always have something to say about that one.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think you're right. It kind of had its heyday in like the 90s, and it kind of like dipped a little bit. But the last 12 months, it's been, yeah, it feels like things are picking up again. So I was looking at some figures the other day, and it said like something like 26 of the UK top 100 firms are now have an office in Leeds, and something like 32% of that have only just entered the city in the last 8 to 10 years, and of that 30%, probably about half in the last 2 years, maybe since COVID. So yeah, suddenly everyone is flocking to Leeds, and I hear rumours every single week about other firms who have expressed an interest or they've approached someone. So yeah, it's busy. Very busy.
Actually, and I think taking the historical view, those of us who've been around for a while, and actually I do remember this sort of the Yorkshire firms coming to London. The Leeds firms were the bedrock of the major advance into London of DLA and Pinsent's and Eversheds and Addleshaws and all of those great names. Now, you intrigue me, the names that are possibly rumoured to be coming in. Why would firms be flocking now? Because it's starting to feel like it's starting to get overloyed, a bit like Manchester a few years ago.
Yeah.
Are people worried about that? Is there room for more entrants?
I think there are, because when you hear of people expressing an interest in Leeds, it's not as if new lawyers are actually entering the city. You're just nabbing a team from someone that already exists. So if we take Gowling, for example, which is there now, it's official, they've moved in and things like
that.
That's
your scoop.
Yep. They have, they took the team from Wumblebourne Dickinson, and it was a real estate team. I think it's primarily in sort of like the house builder sector. So, I mean, they've just taken them, I assume probably taken their clients with them, their expertise. I think they were pretty well known for what they did in Leeds anyway, but they've just stuck them in a different office and they've got a new law firm name above that.
Endless sort of rebadging of teams.
Exactly.
It's going to happen. It's going to be quite interesting.
Yeah.
The other, mentioned sort of house building and real estate. One of the things that you've been talking about to us is the real preponderance of moves within the real estate and energy and infrastructure sectors. It seems to be a bit of a theme that's coming here. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. So, I mean, I think real estate, energy, infrastructure, those sectors do complement each other these days, considering climate change, the race to net zero, and all those issues. But yes, I think real estate primarily, I mean, if you take the house builders, for example, I think Persimmon is actually headquartered in York. You've got others up here like Barrett, Taylor Wimpey, there's so many different house builders that have sites up here. So I think it kind of makes sense. And I think those house builders, they like, unlike others who aren't bothered where their law firms are based, I think they do like to have lawyers closer to home that they can call upon. So I think that's one of the reasons. Energy and infrastructure is an interesting one. I mean, you've got, I think it's Addleshaws, Shoesmiths, Pinsent Masons, there's probably a few others that I've forgotten, all of their heads of energy are based in Leeds.
The national heads of energy?
Yes, I believe
Wow.
And so again, I spoke to people. I was like, is that a coincidence? Is there a reason? They kind of think it's a coincidence. I think some of those people might have been in construction previously, like very early on in their careers, and actually saw the opportunity and perhaps just moved in that direction.
But even though it's not deliberate, there's a sort of an unconscious clustering that's happening, isn't there? That people want, once you get heads of energy that are there, you're going to attract bigger teams, because that's where sort of a lot of the thinking and the strategizing is being done. So that I suspect you're going to see even more growth in that area.
I mean, speaking of national leaders and national teams, how does it work with fees? I mean, you were telling us earlier about how DLA does its fees and lees.
So yeah, as I understand it, DLA Piper's fees are sort of uniform across the UK. So the people in Leeds will be charging exactly the same as those in London. And that's to reflect the level of quality. Like DLA Piper hates the word North Shoring, thinks it's ghastly. And, you know, it wants to, you know, show that and prove it and demonstrate that. So, and then there's other firms as well. I believe Evershed, they said they wouldn't be surprised if they went that way as well, again, to reflect the level of quality.
I suspect they have a whole sort of menu of pricing that where geography is decreasingly important, and it's probably about the value of the specific mandate to a particular business, as opposed to, well, actually it's going to be done in Leeds, so it'll be cheaper or anything like that. But there is a bit of a problem, though, Jess, isn't there? Because, and you've experienced it yourself, this terrible transport in the north. I mean, they talk about kind of, you know, greening the transport. Actually having transport would be a really good thing.
I know. I mean, well, I'll start with a fact, because everyone loves this fact. The length of the Central Line is the same distance between Leeds and Manchester. But the Central Line, there's something like a train every 2-3 minutes, or perhaps even more frequent than that, and you can hop on. But in Leeds, so for example, for me, no one lives in the city centre in Leeds. Well, not many. Everyone's sort of on the outskirts. So for me, I'm only about 10 minutes out of the city centre. So I have to get a train from my village into Leeds. Then I have to change in Leeds, and you might be waiting around for like 20 minutes, half an hour for that train. You get on at Manchester, then you have to work out where in Manchester you actually want to go, because there's something like Manchester Victoria, Manchester Piccadilly. Do you want to go then on the tram further to Salford or somewhere else? Like, it's just so complicating. And then even once you've done that and you get on the train, if you get the fast train, it's something like 52 minutes to Manchester, but that's only once every hour. And if you miss that one, there are only other four or five more trains. And that's if there's no strikes that day or delays, which there usually are. And so the usual train is somewhere between an hour and 90 minutes just to go to Manchester.
And you're speaking as someone who's more in control of your diary, because you don't have clients that you're at the beck and call of, do you? So you can sort of pick and choose when you want to go in. Mm. But those lawyers, I mean, they moan all the time, don't they? And rightly so. It's a terrible, terrible situation.
Well, I mean, I was speaking to someone, one partner in Manchester, and this firm, they have, you know, an office in Manchester. They also have an office in Leeds. And they were saying if the rail was just better, then their offering nationally would just improve so much. There'd be better collaboration. Perhaps they could offer a training seat, and, you know, if they don't offer that seat in Manchester, well, then a couple of days a week they can go over to Leeds or vice versa, because it would just open up so many opportunities. And I think they specifically said it would be a weighty beast to take on London if they could just connect a bit better.
Well, they need an Elizabeth line or Charles line.
Exactly.
Between Leeds and Manchester.
I think I was looking at the miles. I think it's something like 35 miles between Leeds and Manchester, like as the crow flies. And I think the Elizabeth line out to Reading is, I want to say, at least 40, 50. I'm not quite sure. But I mean, it just goes to show the amount of investment that's down south, and not to have too much.
And
of
that
chip
physical
on my shoulder,
infrastructure is really affecting the development of law firms, you know, how they join up, how they talk to their clients, how they talk to each other. It is a bit of a problem. I know that you'll be wanting to return to that in sort of over the sort of coming months, Jess. But in the meantime, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of The Lawyer Podcast.
Thank you for listening. You can contact us at podcast@thelawyer.com. And of course, you can find more about everything we've been discussing at thelawyer.com.
We'll be back again in a fortnight. But until then, goodbye.